It was a cold night, like any other night, with the world fast asleep. The sky was heavy. A thick black cloud moved slowly, like a fetus in the womb. The stillness of the night was disturbed by the creak of the iron door. Three pairs of feet crept into the kitchen, avoiding everything in their way. There was a crash. A plate dropped, shattering into tiny pieces. We stood still, held our breath, waited for someone to make a move. No sound was heard. We crept forward. Once in the living room, we split in different directions. I tiptoed up the stairs and headed for the master bedroom. The door was half closed. I peeped in. A dim blue light welcomed my eyes. I walked to the bedside, where two forms were sleeping under a sheet, peacefully in each other's arms. I watched their faces for a while, hoping that they would not be stubborn in handing over the silver briefcase. Then I tapped the man hard on his shoulder. "My friend, stand up!" He started up and stared at me as if I were an apparition. He looked lost, as if it was all a dream. His eyes left my face, landing on the gun in my hand. "La ilaha illallah." The words fell out of his mouth. Forbidden words. They landed like a missile in my ears. My brain was touched by the alarm those words set off. My blood turned hell hot. I pulled the trigger without a thought, sending a bullet straight into his head. The shot woke the woman by his side. An owl cried outside. I cocked the pistol again. Before the woman could begin her plea, I silenced her. My colleagues came rushing into the room, knowing full well how I could behave in situations like this. But they made a mistake. They came in with the rest of the family. Enraged, I fired blindly, first at the young girl, next an old woman, and I froze in mid-action. The boy, about 11 years, had wet himself. Sweat glistened on his face. His mouth was agape. As I stared at him, gun in hand, cocked and ready to fire, the world stopped moving in my head. The silence in the room became deafening. The screeching of tires followed by gunshots jolted all back to life. Someone might have alerted the police. Instincts told us we needed to disappear from that room. Jakala jumped through the window. Cobra took the back door. But I just stood there, looking from the dead bodies around me to the 11-year-old. His tear-filled eyes stared me in the face. I broke loose from his gaze and absentmindedly groped around the house looking for. I didn't even know. I had never been so destabilized in my 6 years in this enterprise. Taking lives, especially in cold blood, had become some sort of sport that I had come to enjoy. The same way football fans enjoy football. The storm of bullets, punctuated by cries from those hit, reminded me that I was still in enemy territory. I pulled myself together and made to run. Just then,
"Drop your weapon or I fire!"
My gun fell from my hand and my limbs went numb. The next thing I remembered was the hard knocking of my head against the vehicle as it moved on steadily, avoiding potholes. I looked around me. I realized for the first time that I was sitting in a pool of blood, the blood of my associates, as their bodies lay motionless. Then something else struck me, the horrified face of that 11-year-old boy. The look on that face catapulted me back to the place I dreaded so much to return to. It's been 6 years now, but I can still recall the horror like it happened yesterday. Back then in Kano, my best friend Karim and I were returning from school. It was about 4:20 p.m. on that fateful day. We were playing football with a little plastic ball I picked up at school. Karim loved football. He dreamed of one day becoming a big star like JJ Okocha. I loved football too, but my father, who was an architect, he wanted me to be a doctor. I didn't know if I wanted to be a doctor. After all, I was just 11. One thing I knew was that I was fascinated by aeroplanes and would one day like to work inside one. Yes, that was my dream, to be a pilot.
"Uche, pass the ball now," Karim beckoned to me. "Are you not Okocha again? Come and collect it," I shouted back.
A car sped past us. The driver warned us to leave the road. At this time, we were close to our street. We continued our game until I noticed something unusual. "Karim,
Why is everywhere so quiet? I don't know, but... Karim stopped. He looked up. See, is that not smoke coming from that house?
Smoke?
Yes, the house is burning. Come, let us go and...
I wasn't listening anymore. My mind went straight to my family. My father should be at home because he was on leave from work. My mother definitely was at home. She was a caterer and she did her business from the house. My younger sister Agnes would be back from school, and my baby brother Obinna was just 8 months old. As these thoughts went through my mind, my legs began to run. I ran past the burning houses and shops. Our street, which bubbled with life, seemed deserted, quiet like a graveyard. Our street was in the heart of Kano, in a suburb mostly inhabited by northerners. Our neighbors were quite friendly until this crisis started. Since then, we rarely left the house. When either my father or mother wanted to go out to get anything, they wore traditional northern attire, and because they spoke the language very, very well, they got along. So many people from the east had already left Kano for safety, but my father told us that it was very risky to even travel. Many who left never got home, as they were massacred on the way. Besides, I was writing my exams and he wouldn't want me to stop schooling. He had lived here all his life. Kano had become home. And we felt very safe. Until now. I sprinted as fast as my legs could carry me. The road now seemed so far. On getting to the bend that led to my house, I saw thick smoke. My heart missed a beat. And then I came face to face with reality. A raging fire burning my house. First, I was lost as to what was happening. Then I heard voices wailing from inside the fire. I made to run to the flames, but a hand held me back. It was Karim who had run after me. I felt other hands holding me back. I struggled and struggled until the last strength in me faded. While they held me, my father, mother, sister and brother burned to ashes in that house right in front of me. Just that morning, my family had been intact. And now... I was orphaned. I closed my eyes tightly, hoping to wake up from the nightmare. Karim's hand on my back reminded me it wasn't a dream. He wanted to take me away from the smoldering heap, but I wouldn't let him. My sorrow knew no bounds. I sat there. I sat there for 2 days without food or water. My young mind couldn't understand the basis of such cruelty from people we lived with, ate with, talked with, and played with. Worse still, I had never visited my hometown and knew no relatives. So I had nowhere to go. Looking at that ruin killed the child in me. My heart became cold, stone cold. Hatred and bitterness filled my stomach. I yearned for revenge like air, the air that I breathe. Karim's mother, a kind-hearted woman, tried to sneak me into their house at night so I could eat something and have a place to lay my head. But I didn't want her pity, for she was one of them, one of the people who had murdered my innocence. If this crisis is ever over, I thought, as I stood up from the heap of that ruin 3 days later, it will be only for those who lost nothing. But for me, it would be far from over. It would be... just the beginning of war. Those words filled my heart as I began to walk away to nowhere.
My friend, stand well, well.
The court usher's voice jerked me back to reality. I realized I was slumping. I look around. Everyone is staring at me, some in pity, some in confusion. In an attempt to avoid their eyes, I glance at the clock. 3:15 p.m. I must have been standing in that courtroom for 4 hours. The judge seems busy with her writing. What will the judgment be? Sincerely, I don't care. I don't even feel sorry for what I have done. I lost the luxury of such feeling that day in Kano 6 years ago. My thought drifts off again to where I could have been now. In the university, maybe, studying to either be a doctor, as my father wanted, or a pilot.
But here I am at the University of Society, where at 17, after going through rigorous lectures on the streets and under the bridges, I am already a graduate of crime and murder with first-class honors. Someone walking towards me brings me back to reality. It is that familiar face again. The 11-year-old boy whose family I killed on that cold night. He smiles at me and hands me a white handkerchief. Everyone watches in silence. I stare at him in confusion. A sign of peace from a child whose parents I killed. I cannot understand it, and for the first time in 6 years, tears well up in my eyes, just as the judge exhales deeply in readiness to give her judgment.